We're justice-seeking people. We say this all the time. This is a justice-minded church. Well, justice has a few meanings. For example, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, this is one of the oldest justice statements. This goes all the way back to Hammurabi, and we still actually hold this principle to an extent. We say the punishment should fit the crime. Now, most of us who know much about the American judicial system know that that doesn't usually happen quite that way, that sentence requirements are different in ways that don't always seem fair. The little tug of war we have between people who do something wrong and what we're going to do about it is often a very unfair game. If you have power and money, chances are you will do little time for a crime that perhaps did way more damage than a petty theft perpetrated by someone who has very little. We all know this. But we actually have the principle that it shouldn't be like that. That if we're going to have a justice system, it ought to be fair. And it ought to treat everyone equally. In fact, right there on the Supreme Court, equality under the law. This is a principle we hold in this nation. And it goes all the way back to Hammurabi. And it comes through the Hebrew scriptures. And Jesus said, you know, you've heard this, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. While we have a tendency to not want to trade body parts, we do want to trade numbers of years for amount of damage. We'll take this number of years from your life for doing this amount of damage to your fellow citizen. This is not at all what Jesus is advocating. And in the Bible study on Wednesday, we got a little tripped up because I had not done my homework about the word resistance. Do not resist an evildoer. Well, I knew that that wasn't really the best translation, but I couldn't remember. I had actually the Greek, but I didn't have my lexicon. And, you know, Greek was 25 years ago, and good Lord. I don't remember it as well as I ought to, and I'm getting old and kind of menopausal and what have you. So the fact that I can't remember some of my Greek is good. I try to remember your names first, all right? But the word that's translated here is resistance. And by the way, this enters the English translation with Good King Jimmy. And Good King Jimmy, the King James translation, as you might imagine, having been ordered by a monarch, was not real interested in encouraging any upheavals or resistance to power. So they translated resistance, and that's still in our NRSV, but the Greek word is antisthene. Well, anti, be against, sthene, stand up. Now, you could say, well, that being against standing up, that could, well, yeah, that could be resistance, I suppose. But you also need to know a little bit that this word is used in translating the Hebrew Bible into Greek, a thing we call the Septuagint. And it's usually used as a very technical war term. That it literally, as the two armies would run towards one another, the antisthene was just before you took the stand. Very technical term. So maybe this translation would be better to say, do not fight evildoers. Do not resist evil. Do not fight evil on its own terms. Return no one evil for evil. This is really the kind of justice. So instead of equality under the law, which is absolutely a wonderful way to think about justice, we're pro-equality, we want that, but there is this third way, as Walter Wink says. There is a third path that Jesus is suggesting here, that is neither punishment fits the crime. We will absolutely try to get equality in balancing the scales of justice. And it is not resistance, passive resistance, as in be a doormat. And this passage has been used to make doormats of people. It has been used in the same way that Good King Jimmy wanted the people to not fight the monarch. It has been used to tell battered women, don't resist. It has been used to tell oppressed people, turn the other cheek. This is not what it means. So just in our kind of crazy tug of war example, I'll give you how it was supposed to go. But see, life is always messier. This is good. When you do this sort of thing, you realize how messy this always is. So the simple solutions that happened in my brain are, of course, not what happened, which is, of course, what happens in the real world. In the real world, simply refusing to play the game is actually the only strategy for ending the game. In our personal relationships, when we're feeling sort of victimized by someone, someone's oppressing us or picking on us, our tendency is to answer back in our victimhood with kind of giving back exactly what we got. And there is some equality in that if we're picking on somebody our own size. But it doesn't end the game. What ends the game is when we refuse to play at all. And we refuse to play on the terms of the one with power that is exercising it against us. We've seen good examples of this. It can be very creative, very subtle. In South Africa during the struggle against apartheid, one of the things that black servants did is they started calling their masters, their employers, by their first names. This often got them backhanded, which is the whole thing of turn the other cheek. You know, if you backhand someone, that's an inferior. And if you turn the other cheek and say, nope, slap me full on like your equal, and this is how it was in Jesus' day, if you were less than somebody, they backhanded you. If you were their equal, they hit you this way. This cloak business is, I think, very amusing. It reminds me of something that's been going on in San Francisco. You have to understand that the people Jesus is talking to, they can't sue anybody. They only get sued. Only rich people can sue. Poor people can't sue anybody in this culture of Jesus's. It's a little hard to do now. They can't sue anybody, but they got sued regularly, and since they had nothing, the only thing that the person suing them would get is their cloak. But here's the thing. In this culture, nudity was not tolerable. So if you gave them your linen ephod, your undergarment as well, you were naked, and that was shameful to the person who was suing you because they saw your nakedness. And you say, why does this remind me of current events? I mean, in San Francisco, in my neighborhood in the Castro, we got a bunch of naked guys. And we recently have been through this incredible turmoil led by our supervisor, Scott Wiener. You know, you can't make this up. He really is named Scott Wiener. So Supervisor Wiener actually passed an ordinance that said you can't be naked in San Francisco except at Folsom Street and at the Beta Breakers, but not in the Castro sitting on the community furniture that we have there. Now, I don't feel a great need to go naked in the Castro. First of all, it's too cold most of the time. But secondly, you know, okay, so they're naked. And why is it always the unattractive ones? But, you know, they're naked. But why did we pass an ordinance? We passed an ordinance because we're embarrassed. We're embarrassed by their nakedness. We're embarrassed of all the tourists who come to the Castro, and we just assume that there weren't a bunch of naked guys sitting there, even though they tend to think it's really cool and get their pictures made with them, which of course encourages the behavior. But, you know, we're embarrassed. We're embarrassed that we have naked guys in the Castro, and we're embarrassed that they aren't cuter. So, you know, this, I kind of get it. You know, it would be humiliating if you sue someone and they just take all their clothes off. You'd be standing there going, oh, really? Really? This is really embarrassing. And actually, in that time, it would be way past embarrassing. It was actually humiliating and made you unclean. You wouldn't be able to go to temple. You couldn't show your face. The going the extra mile, we've used that to be, you know, do a little bit more. Well, this was an act of revolution in Jesus' time. Going a mile for someone is what happened when the Roman army came marching through. They had the right, and here again, Roman law had a certain fairness to it, that any villager could be forced to carry the 75 to 85 pound packs of these soldiers for 1 mile, and not 1 inch longer. And remember, Roman roads were measured in miles. This is where we get the word mile from, is from these Roman roads. So they would literally come into a village. The villagers often ran off into somewhere to hide when they saw them coming, because they would have to carry the army's baggage for a mile. Well, if you kept carrying it, the soldier got in trouble because he was only allowed to let you do it for 1 mile. And if you carried it a second mile, then he would be punished by his superiors. It's an act of resistance that is not fighting, but it is still resistance. We refuse to play the games on your terms. Jesus' third way is refusing to play the game of war, of I'm better than you, you're better than me, on the same terms. Return no one evil for evil. Literally, it's not a matter of not resisting so much as it is resisting in ways that do not follow the rules of the game. Stop playing the game. I look at world events, and in the Bible study, we talked about this. I said, okay, so let's talk about the Ukraine, and let's talk about Syria. How does this apply? How does this apply? How do you stop playing the game? Arming the rebels? I think that's still being in the game. Removing the leader, well, if you could do it without playing the game, maybe. How do we suggest a third way in the world? We've seen it work. We did see it work in South Africa. We saw a third way. In fact, Nelson Mandela's first way was simply to try to beat them at their own game. And how did he win? By refusing to play the game. When we refuse to play, we win. Now, most of y'all are old enough to remember a movie called War Games. Anybody remember this movie? Matthew Broderick? Well, it's a small subset. Well, it's great. These kids basically hack. He's a hacker, and he hacks in to the government computers, but he doesn't really know that's what he's done, and there's this computer that plays war games, computer war games, and this is how they simulate what would happen in a thermonuclear war. And the kid doesn't really get that he is actually in a computer that is inside the government that could actually control these weapons, potentially. He just thinks he's playing a cool game. We're just gonna blow up some things, and then they'll blow up some things. And so he plays thermonuclear war. And of course, you know, you see what happens when there's a Russian first strike, and you see what happens when there's an American first strike, and you try to counter it, and you know, you play the game, and you try to equal the sides out, and that's what you do. Well, the computer kind of gets on a mind of its own, and somehow there's a miscommunication. Of course, this always happens in a movie, and not like in real life. And there's a miscommunication. And all of a sudden, the American military thinks the Russians have attacked. And they can't stop the computer to stop the simulation. And so there's this, you know, great chase scene, and they have to get past all the guards, and they run here and there and everywhere else, and it's, you know, really exciting. And we get right down to the moment when the missiles are about to be fired, and they manage to get into the computer, and they manage to get the computer to simply, instead of firing the missiles, to simply play the game all the way out. And it plays, and boom, boom, boom. We see all of what would happen in thermonuclear war, and it's a big graphic example. And at the end, the computer says, What a strange game. The only way to win is never to play at all. Would you like a nice game of chess? Look for the third way. Look for the third way. Try as you might, even when somebody annoys the living bejesus out of you, or actually does something truly cruel and awful, look for a way to not play the game.